For the next half hour, another methodological thing that I want to do. I figured if I was going to do that, which is uber technical and confusing, we're going to do something else that is totally the other side, okay? So, in the following half an hour, this is what I want to do. Last week, we looked at the story of Herod, okay? And we noted that seven times throughout the story, there's this pairing of king versus melech. King versus slave. And we talked about how it seems to be playing with notions of true kingship and avdus and the like. My personal read, based on the final end of the Gemara, was that it's actually a somewhat positive perspective. At the end of the day, once he humbles himself and actually talks to Bava Ben Buta and takes the advice, that he gains greatness, either because the Gemara finally acknowledges him as Melech, right, or because it says he's chayim mitzvot as an eved. Who was not here last week and doesn't know the story that I have to recap? Okay, quick recap of this Gemara that we did it in Shir, so you know it's someone. But recap of the Gemara. The Gemara says that it's talking about the halachot of destroying a shul to rebuild it. In that context, it talks about the destruction, not the destruction, the dismantling parts of Beit HaMikdash for the rebuilding of Herod, and tells the story that Herod... Second, it's raining. That Herod was a servant. He heard a bat call that said, if any slave who rebels today will be successful, he kills all the Chashmonaim except for one girl from the Chashmonai family who he decides he wants to marry. She decides not to marry him, but instead jumps off a roof and screams, anyone who claims that they're from the Chashmonai family is a slave, because I was the last one and died. So Herod preserves her body in honey, and the Gemara has a machoket, either to pretend that she was alive so that people would think he's king, or to sleep with her because he was so attracted to her, so he kept her body healthy. In the meantime, because he's a slave, the rabbis don't approve of him being king because it's a violation of the pasuk. So he kills all the rabbis, and except for Bava Ben Buta, who he blinds, he goes to Bava Ben Buta, tries to get him to curse him. After many unsuccessful attempts, he admits that he is Herod, and he says, if I'd known the rabbis were so careful and so respectful, I never would have killed all of you. Great. What should I do? So the Gemara says that Bava Ben Buta told him, build the Beit HaMikdash, because you blinded the eyes of the world. And now you should reignite reignite it by rebuilding the Beit HaMikdash. And he says, but I'm scared of the Romans. So he said, easy, stall for time, send a letter, let it take a year, let him dawdle there for a year and come back for a year. By the end of it, you'll have already rebuilt the Beit HaMikdash. The Romans pick up on it and send a letter, and they say, if you haven't dismantled the Beit HaMikdash, don't. If you already did, don't rebuild it. And if you did, you're a bad slave. Bad. Right. And then the Gemara goes on, and eventually it says, well, how could Bava Ben Buta let him build the Beit HaMikdash? Isn't that a problem with giving him schar, like the Nebuchadnezzar Gemara with staka? And he says, don't worry about it. Either he's an eved, therefore he's chayiv in mitzvot, so he's allowed to build the Beit HaMikdash, or you're allowed to ask a king to build the Beit HaMikdash, because that's the only way the Beit HaMikdash is going to be built. So I argued last week this constant pairing of slave and melech is actually a positive. Right, teaching you that real malchus is not about power. At the end of the day, the only time the rabbis call him melech is at the end, when he humbles himself to Bava Ben Buta. Or they say, no, you're right, he is a servant, but that's why he's chayv in mitzvos, and that actually is why he's allowed to build the Beit HaMikdash. Right, it's not about status as much as it is about doing the right thing. That was my read of the Gemara. Now, much of my analysis was based on Yonatan Feintuch, but he actually has a different conclusion of the Gemara. He thinks that the purpose of the Gemara was not to teach you what Herod did at the end was good, but was the exact opposite, right? He thinks that the point of this Gemara is that the whole world praised Herod for all his building projects, and the point of this Gemara was to say, you think Herod was so great? It wasn't even his idea, it was the blind rabbi, right? The rabbis are the ones that are really responsible for the Beit HaMikdash being rebuilt. Herod, you think he's so great? Pasmish, right? It wasn't even his idea, right? That this is actually Chazal's way of undermining Herod's contribution to the Beit HaMikdash. Now, here, the support for that read is, and this is where I want to introduce you to comparative study, is the following. One of the modern methodologies of studying Agadah. So there are a lot of modern scholars, including Jeffrey Rubinstein, who we'll talk about in a second, who study it the way we did last week, literarily, right? Trying to understand what is the message based on literary analysis of the Agadah. But there's also a big area of study in Gemara in general, where people try to understand the Chazal and better understand the world of Chazal in light of the world that they lived in. Now, what world did they live in? So they lived in modern-day Iran, right, in Persia, under the Sasanian Empire, okay, where the major religion was Zoroastrianism, okay? Ifra Hormuz is a Zoroastrian.
Under her?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought they were
under
Hormuz.
No. So, right, that is who they are. And a lot of work has been done to understand Chazal in light of this reality. Okay? Yaakov Elman, Rabbi Dr. Yaakov Elman, Zecharno Levracha, was one of the fathers of this field. He's a professor at YU and at Harvard. Several people have written on it in Halacha. Right, Shai Secunda has written about it primarily in Nida, because Zoroastrians were super, 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 super machmir in Nida. Really, really machmir. Like, you think we're machmir, gewalt, we're nothing. Right? They literally locked their women when they were in Nida in little huts outside the town with a little, like, food door. Like, it was really quite machmir. Which is why in the Gemara you have all types of conversations where Ifra Hormuz and Nida ask the rabbis Nida questions. Because they also have menstrual laws. So they could have conversations about it. And in fact, often in the Gemara, when a woman will say she's a Nida, she'll use the phrase that was common parlance in the Sasanian Empire, which is Dashtina'ana. Right? I am Dashtina'ana. I'm a Nida. That's all it is. Okay? And Shai Secunda argues that a lot of the chumrot that we have in Nida were really Chazal tell you that the biggest chumras in Nida come not from the top down, not from rabbis, but Benot Yisrael Hechmiru al Atzman. Right? The most major chumra in all of Hilchos Nida is because the women were machmir. Right? And one of his arguments is that the reason that the women were so machmir was because the whole world they lived in was machmir. So like, we, even all of the chumras we had were nothing compared to what the world was doing, but that was the culture. Right? That's part of his argument. Okay. And Agadah Tzadis becomes very important, and we're going to see that a lot in Bava Batra, especially in the fifth parak, in the crazy, wild, unbelievable Agadah Tzadis of the battles against the Saro Shel Yam, right? The battles against the angel of the sea, and the sea swallowing up death, and all types of really wonderful Agadah Tzadis there that are, everyone has gotten in on that action. The Gra has a Perush on it. Rav Kook has a Perush on it. I really was like trying to find everything to track it down so I could copy for you. And then Rice Sklar made it easy for me and showed me that after the terrorist attack at the Merkaz Harav High School, are you too young to remember this? You're probably too young. In 2007, I think, I was in Shanabet. 8 high school students were killed in the Merkaz Harav High School. So one of the fathers, as his commemoration project, put together a website where he went through every single Agadah in that fifth perek and compiled every one of the Mefarshim in a pre-made source sheet, because that is what he taught for the year in memory of his son. So it's all organized, so it's ready. But one of the things that he didn't really go with is that some of it is response to things in mythology. And it makes sense that if you want to teach lessons and there's a mythology going around, you want to show how we are distinct from the culture around you. So what you do is you take the myth and you tweak it, right? It's why satire works, right? You take a trope that's well known and you just change it a little bit, right? So a lot of the studies of Iranian Talmudica, And if you, you know, the Shai Secunda has really written basically a introductory textbook to this called the Iranian Talmud, which is really, really an excellent brief of this field. If you want, you can borrow it, but you really have to give it back. It's a very expensive academic book, which I, you know, I need to make sure that it makes it back to my house. You can only have one book at a time from my house, yes. If you want another book, you got to return the one you currently borrowed, okay? Okay, so in the 20 minutes I have until Rav Ashi starts, so Jeffrey Rubenstein is one of the leading scholars of Agadata in the academic world. I'm still dry. It's a little bit noisy, but I'm still dry. So Jeffrey Rubenstein wrote this, and he wanted to understand, and he said, if you really want to understand this story, you have to realize that this is not an attempt at a historical story. Because many modern scholars have wondered, why does the account of the rabbis differ so much from Josephus? So his argument is that this is a story that is meant to play on an Iranian story about Ardashir. About Ardashir. Okay? And I want to basically give you a taste of what Iranian comparative studies with the Talmud looks like and what it adds to this story. What? What? That's satire. I mean, it is satiric, but it means a response, right? I mean, Agata says, remember, if they're not literal, then they can be that. So he starts off with this wonderful description of our Gemara, which I happen to like. I'll just read it to you. He says, the Bavli's story of Herod at Bava Batra 3b to 4a can be counted amongst the most colorful and dramatic Talmudic stories. It features not only sex and death, but sex with death. He does have a turn of phrase, I've got to say. He's very good. Its characters include kings and sages. The story involves politics, deception, and intrigues, and it explains the events that caused the rebuilding of the Jerusalem temple. Okay, that's his summary of the story. Now, right, he notes that most modern scholars have tried to figure out in what way are the rabbis influenced by Josephus. And he summarizes that Daniel Schwartz has aptly summarized both the connections to and discrepancies from the Josephine accounts. He notes, quote, looking back at this long account, we first note that the main lines of this story are correct. Herod did begin his career as a servant of the Hasmoneans. He did rise to power by replacing them. He did marry a Hasmonean princess. She did die in confrontation with him. He did build the second temple. Moreover, it is also clear that this Talmudic narrative contains some echoes of the very specific events of that story. Thus, if the Talmud reports that that Maryam killed herself by jumping off a roof, Josephus reports the same of the wife of Herod's brother, Pharaohus. The Talmudic story of Herod secretly approaching Beva ben Buta and testing to see if he would curse the king is paralleled in Josephus' report that Herod used to snoop around incognito and listen to his subjects talking about him. Right, so there are parts of this that are similar to the stories we have with Josephus. On the other hand, there are cases in which Josephus contradicts Herod's account in the Gemara. Namely, it is obvious that while there is much which is wrong historically in the rabbinic story, thus none of us would consent to replace Josephus' story of Miriam's trial and execution, which is how it is in Josephus, that he tried his wife and had her killed, and trading verses, by the Talmudic suicide story, and none of us can imagine Herod going on and trading verses with a blind sage. None of us would consent to replacing Josephus' account, which says the temple was built in 9.5 years, with the added the rabbis that said it was built in 3. But Rubenstein claims that this whole methodology is just wrong. Meaning, yes, they are building on history based on things like Josephus, but Schwartz is basically saying, you know, they got things right, and it's a bit of a historical fiction. So that's basically Schwartz's approach. Eli Yassif basically has no problem with it for that exact reason. He says it's a folklore. It's historical fiction. So it has certain historical facts and certain things that they play with. But Rubenstein claims that the influence for this story and its changes from the history are, again, not Josephus and not folklore, but is their knowledge of King Arshadir. Because he's not just any king. Who is King Arshadir? Ardashir, rather. He's the founder of the Sasanian Empire. Okay? And here is a summary of the story of Ardashir. Yeah. The 6th century, the record we have is a 6th century CE of the story. Okay? No, no, this is the record that we have of the story. Right? The story. The story as we have it, we have a record of it from the 6th century. So we're talking before that, but this is the record of the story, okay? So here's the story as it goes, okay? Habag, a nobleman and governor of Fars, has auspicious dreams about his shepherd Sazen, a descendant of the old Persian kings, and gives Sazen his daughter in marriage. She gives birth to a son, Ardashir, whom Habag adopts and educates. King Ardawan, IV, Artabanus IV, okay, hears of young Ardashir's exquisite talents and equestrian ability. He's a good horse rider, that's all that means. And summons Ardashir to his court to join his retinue. During a hunting expedition, Ardashir quarrels with Ardawan's son when the prince claims to have shot an antelope that Ardashir in fact killed. Ardawan sides with his son and reprimands Ardashir and then relegates him to the stables to take care of the horses. This naturally embitters Ardashir and kindles resentment towards the bitter family. Okay, this is where we pick up. Sometime after, Ardawan consults with his astrologers and soothsayers about what they see in the stars. He receives an ominous response. Then the chief of the soothsayers came forward and said, "It is so revealed that whichever servant who will escape from his master within 3 days from today will reach greatness and sovereignty and will become successful and victorious over his own master." Does that start to sound familiar? Like the very weird Batkol, right? The Batkol that comes out. And then it continues. A favorite servant girl of the king, referred to as a certain maiden, overhears the astrologer's talk. She had become enamored of Ardashir and fallen in love with him. She informed Ardashir of the astrologer's words. The two take a pair of fine horses and flee. Ardawan discovers this slave girl is missing, hears of their flight, pursues them but cannot overtake them, returns home after 3 days. Ardashir allies, raises an army, fights a series of battles, eventually killing Ardawan and other members of the royal family, and marrying his daughter. After making more alliances and fighting additional battles, he becomes king of kings, inaugurating the Sasanian dynasty. Yes. So here's where he says, right? He says, suddenly you see certain things. So for example, Ardashir is a servant in the house of Ardawan. Or in the Babli, Herod is a servant in the house of Chashmonaim, and he hears a voice that says, whichever servant will rebel will be successful. So he argues that Chazal understood the transition from the Hasmonean or Herodian dynasties through the prism of the transition from the Parthian to the Sasanian dynasties. And they identified, either historically or more likely morally, Herod with Ardashir. And here are So, right, in both places we have the servant who becomes king, right? The stable master servant Ardashir and Herod, thank you. But then you get the following. Ardashir claims to be a descendant of Persian kings, and therefore deserves to be a king by right. And the second similarity is the Batkol. Though he notes that if you look in the manuscripts, it's not clear that it says Batkol. In many of the manuscripts, it doesn't say Batkol. You know what it says? Just Kol. He heard a voice. Right? So in many of them, it's not a voice from heaven. It's just a voice, which is what you have in... Right? In this story, that it's just a story from a... just he overheard it from a girl. Right? That someone... told him. And Chazal, therefore, even if it's Batkol, what are they doing? They're replacing the idolatrous story, which involves the astrologers, with either just a kol, right, or a voice from heaven. So either way, right, it's claiming maybe there is a divine aspect to this, but it's God, not the astrologers. Right, then he goes, then he notes that a third issue is that in both stories, this slave king kills his masters. Herod kills all of them. In the story of Ardashir, he doesn't kill all of them, but he kills most of them, imprisons the rest, and leaves basically one who he, a girl who he marries, right? And he kills off all maidens except for one, right? To marry, quote, when Ardashir ben Babak had attained royal power, he wrought great slaughter upon the Arasids, etc. And he killed them. It is mentioned that he left no one alive except a maiden who he had found in the royal palace. He was struck by her beauty and asked her. She was really the slaughtered king's daughter about her origins. So in this case, he doesn't kill her, but in both of them, right, in the Bavli, he does attempt to make it look like he married her, according to one day on the Bavli, right, by preserving her body in honey. Right, so it's obviously different, but the maintaining her in honey so it looks like I'm married brings the stories closer together, right? In one, he actually married the daughter of the princess. In one, he made it look like he did. So they're different, right? But clearly there's a thematic parallel. But here's where Rubenstein says, so one way to look at it is, look, it's a parallel and a loose parallel. But the alternative is that this is exactly the point, that the message of the story is here at the inversion. That Ardashir is the father of the Sasanian dynasty because he kills the old dynasty and marries into it. Herod, according to him, right? Remember I said, he's of the opposite approach. That this story isn't praising Herod. What's it doing? Undermining his authority. So how do you do that? If everyone knows the story of Ardashir, who manages to become the legitimate king by killing out the previous king and marrying the remaining part of the Malchut, then if you want to say that Herod is a illegitimate king, so you tell the same story, but at the moment when he marries into true kingship, what do? Exactly. You take the princess away and have her die and have him only pretend. Right? So he argues that if you want to understand this story, you realize it's an inversion of the story of the real king, right, of Ardashir. The fifth point he notes in the story is that both Herod and Ardashir are known as great builders of temples, right? That is one of the things Ardashir is known 4. And therefore, having Herod being known for building the Beit HaMikdash and talking about him on the back of a Mardashir makes sense. Then he notes that you actually have a parallel to the end of the story, the Roman rebuke. Right? When the Romans rebuke Herod and say, you are really a slave, so you actually have the following parallel in the story of Ardashir after his rebellion, where Ardawan sends an insulting letter to Ardashir and says, you have presumed beyond your rank in society and have brought down on yourself destruction. O Kurd, brought up among the tents of Kurds, who gave you leave to assume the crown on your head and permission to seize all the territories you have assembled together, and whose rules and peoples you have subdued? Who ordered you build the city which you founded in the desert? When we allow you to go ahead and construct it, then build a city in the desert, ... Meaning you have a letter from the old king to Ardashir, which says, you have no right to build the city until we tell you, which is? Right, exactly what the Romans tell Herod. Now, you even have the motif in the story of Ardashir, that Ardashir ends up regretting killing all of the previous kings and tries to find a way of doing tshuva, and you find him crying, and Ardashir comes to do tshuva. And it does sound that what is one of the ways that he does tshuva?
By
building temples. Right? That for him, that seems to be part of it. Now, Ardashir actually has other rebellions and massacres and the like. So Rubenstein, as I said, claims that, unlike we concluded last week, that this is actually saying that at least at the end of his life, once Herod humbled himself, he was okay. He's saying, no, this is the rabbi's attempt to undermine Herod's legitimacy by saying, you're not really a king. Even all the great things you did came about by the rabbis. But the real way that they shtuch him is by saying, here's your story mapped onto Ardashir, who's the real king. Right? That was like the story of the real king. You're like that, except he actually married the daughter of the king because he's a real king and you're not. And he actually built things and you built things as the rabbis told you. Right? So he claims that this is basically a historical fiction, right, which combines history from what the Jews knew, from things like Josephus and their own histories, but maps it on to a well-known motif from the story of the real king, and at each of the points that would legitimate Herod's king by making him look Ardashir, he flips it to show that Ardashir is a king, but you're not. Right? And therefore his conclusion is, several elements of what we might call the core historical tradition of the lives of Herod and Ardashir seem to have influenced the sages to view Herod's life in light of Ardashir's. They include the basic facts that both were usurpers who founded dynasties, new dynasties both rebuilt temples, perhaps that both killed incumbents of the ruling dynasty, etc. The sages consequently imagined and constructed a story of Herod's rise to power that borrowed from Sasanian traditions about Ardashir's ascent. Most importantly, they seem to explain why Herod was able to seize power on the basis of the Sasanian tradition that explained Ardashir's success, namely that Ardashir rebelled at the auspicious time for slaves to try him over their masters, the time determined by astrologers on the basis of the celestial bodies. In this way, the rabbis portrayed the transition from the Hasmonean to Herodian dynasty on the basis of the change from Parthian to Sasanian dynasties. But deviations between the rabbinic and Sasanian stories, especially with regard to the marriage of the previous dynasty, can be explained in terms of the opposite bias of the storytellers. The Sasanians portray Ardashir as a legitimate king, where the sages portray Herod as an illegitimate usurper. The appreciation of the Sasanian traditions help us to understand aspects of the rabbinic narrative that deviate from accounts found in Josephus and other historians, and seem to have no basis whatsoever in historical reality. It is surely possible, though speculative, that a rabbinic story viewing more closely to Josephus' account was later revised under the influences of Sasanian sources. But given the lack of rabbinic parallels in earlier versions, it is difficult to reconstruct the stages of the story's composition. And then he notes, right, that if this is the case, it only highlights the importance of understanding that the rabbis were aware of their Sasanian tradition, and to fully get the message of Chazal, you need to realize the world they lived in. Okay? So this is a brief introduction to what the world of Iranian Talmudica looks like. There are a lot of fascinating things that come out from it. Some of them are speculative. Some of them I find very compelling. Sometimes you literally cannot understand Chazal if you don't understand this. I'll give you one example, then I'll leave you to Rav Ashi. This is a halachic one, but if you don't believe me in the importance of this sometimes. So there's a machloket in Shabbos Ayin Hei as to Magoshta. Why are the Magoshta Chayev Mita? Are they blasphemers, Begadzvim, or are they magicians, Mechashvim? What? They're two, right? So you'll say, what's the difference? But what is the machlokes even? So Shai Segunda came to YU once and he says, it's very simple. What's a magoshta? We know what a magoshta is. It's not a, right? It's not, no, we know exactly what it is. What is it? It's a Zoroastrian magi. Okay? Right? They're like religious practitioners. The Zoroastrian magi believe, they believe that they got their power from mumbling Shame Hashem over and over and over again. And with it, they could do magic. Which means, and what are Rav and Shmuel arguing about?
Which point of magic?
Very good. Is they think they perform magic by misusing the name of God. So which is the problem? So actually, in the eyes of Chazal, is it the name of Hashem, Yud Kei Vav Kei? Answer that question for me. Is it?
No.
Yes! Have you ever learned Yoma? That they used to say their real Shem Hashem, and what did they do? The Kohen Gadol would swallow the name so no one could hear it. And what story does the Chazal say? Why? Who are they hiding it from? Because there was once a Zoroastrian, there was once a Magoshta, who came into the Beit HaMikdash to try to hear the name. Chazal believe that in a Hanami, that they're trying to find Shem Hashem. They believe that they were using Shem Hashem. So yes, and this is one of those things, that there's a lot that you can get, that if you don't understand, right, the background of what Chazal knew about the Sasanian world, you'll miss things, right? So this is just a small example of how this adds to the story of Herod, but there are many other examples in Halacha and Agada. Yes, Yonatan, your last question, because I'm already over time, and Ravashi has you.
A word that is like the name of God that you can, like, say, or, like, do magical things?
Well, what?
So they think
Do Chazal believe that? Yeah, they may very well believe that. Or at least it's possible. That's a story for another time, yeah. It's a fascinating story, but yeah, they might very well, right? They talk about it, right? Like with Moshe Rabbeinu using the Shem Hashem to kill the Mitzri. Okay? But I hope that's at least an introduction to why it's important, or important. I'm not telling you have to do this. I'm saying that there's a whole world of understanding, especially Agadata, in light of realizing that part of what Agadata may be is a moral story that is told on the backdrop of motifs that they're inverting to teach where we diverge. But in order to fully understand their message, right, the same way nowadays, right, if you wanted to tell a story, right, if you wanted to, whatever, you want to understand what I'm doing with Lord of the Rings, you have to know Lord of the Rings, otherwise you won't understand the, right, what I'm talking about. But if I'm using it as a mashal for Shmuel, you have to have watched it, right? Right, that's what it is.
I now watch it now.
Now you'll watch it. Okay, good. Go to Rav Ashi. Go.